Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
And it's time for another classic example of Tipperary Tales under the tutelage of our ace author from Tipperary, of course, Jenny Finch.
Hello. This episode is from February 2022. Well, what a few weeks we've had here in Tipperary. We take time on Saturday evening to reflect on the past days over a special meal. And this week realised every week has been busy ever since we arrived. It is a year round now since we first began the move into our house. Well, one day short. It was a lovely house then, if in need of some TLC, and making it ours has been part of the adventure. We've done our best to make it even lovelier and certainly more comfortable. Sometimes this works splendidly, like the gas heating. Sometimes it's a bit more difficult. Last week, we had Des, our gardener and friend, working in the wood for 3 days. We decided to focus on the trees and see what could be saved and how to help the healthy trees flourish. This meant a great cutting of ivy, brambles, and dead bindweed that was choking many of them. Des had to take this slowly as the ivy offers excellent accommodation for birds and we won't disturb the nests. The back of the wood is now more open, letting in light and with fewer dangerous overhangs. Cause for optimism despite the continuing and necessary loss of some trees. One thing we wanted to change was the power supply to the water pump. We spent months trying to arrange site visits, then had the ground prepared, and finally the system was installed. Unfortunately, it didn't work. We wondered if this was due to lack of light or sun on the panels. After the redoubtable Eddie did a few checks, we found it was partly due to the pump itself. Most water pumps pull up to 1.2 kilowatts when they start up and then just tick over. Ours pulls 4.5 kilowatts and keeps going full blast. No wonder it's so expensive to run. Now we have an interesting series of steps to sequence, not my great strength. We have the pump man coming next week, as it will need replacing. Then he will hopefully move the pressure tank and reset the pipes. Eddie will need to be on hand to do the wiring, and he's going to replace the solar system to suit the task. This will be a mixed setup that switches between panels, mains, and batteries, and in the winter, this will ensure a constant water supply. In the summer, excess power will be fed into the house to save on the electricity bill. If we had known how it all works, we'd have asked for this first, but we're learning new stuff the whole time, so no harm done. And we will finally be able to get rid of the butt-ugly shed. I am looking forward to that part of the adventure. The same day Eddie called, we also had John, the drain man. How he stays so upbeat considering his job, I don't know, but he was great. He hosed the main drain, some remaining fatberg, but the blockages were mainly years of lime scale. He checked the tank, gave the system a clean bill of health, and recommended we have the last lot of guttering diverted into a soaker well. A huge relief as we were contemplating new drains and all the disruption and cost that entails. All we have to do now is keep an eye on the grease trap, yuck, and arrange for yet another workman, Paddy, to do the gutters. So many jobs have different specialists here. We now have 2 Johns, 3 Derricks, an Aidan, 1 each of Davy, Dom, Fergus and Eddie, and Des, of course. They will soon be joined by Tom and Paddy. My phone is full of workmen's contact details. I'm heading to the local hospital on Monday for my first physio session, and none too soon. My right shoulder, used to be my good shoulder, was the problem. Although I'm still resting it and doing a new jigsaw, I popped my left shoulder too. So contrary to what many of my students say, I am now totally armless. I was putting some strain on it, reaching up a little to the keyboard and the mouse with the new desk, and I can't get my chair to rise at all. I did one broadcast for Southside with only the top of my head visible. So I've tried different cushions and now perch on a piece of redundant sofa foam. It's 12 centimetres high and looks ridiculous, but it does the job. Oh, the world isn't made for short people like me. I hope to find someone to fix the chair as it's normally very comfortable, but I'm not holding my breath. In a different country and post-COVID world, everything is much slower and harder to find. Maybe that's also part of the adventure. Despite temporary setbacks and some health problems, moving was still one of the best decisions we ever made, and we are generally ridiculously happy. This has been a very eventful few weeks, and not just because of the weather. That has had quite an impact, of course. In fact, looking back, I'm surprised we did as much as we have. After a bright and relatively warm January, February arrived, determined to live up to its reputation. The first few days were not too bad, a bit showery and blustery, but fairly decent, and we began to travel hopefully. First up was a trip to the local hospital for my long-awaited physiotherapy appointment. The physio was very good, extremely helpful, and gave me some exercises to do at home. He also furnished me with a pulley stretcher to go over a door. It looks a bit like some dubious item of torture, but actually helps develop and stretch the shoulder muscles. Jackie helped me fit it over the door, and all I have to do is remember to use it every day. No frozen shoulders for me. That was the good news. The bad news was he was leaving the department, and there is, so far, no replacement. Glad I sneaked in before he left. On Tuesday, the pump man, Tom, called in to look at the water pump. It's fine, apparently. The problem is the controller that doesn't regulate it properly and so is burning up electricity needlessly. He's coming back to do the moving and upgrading soon, and now the sequencing comes in. My Achilles heel. Well, one of them anyway. First, we need to clear the Majestic, ready for the installation. Then Eddie has to fit the new solar system. And then on the same day, Tom will relocate the pressure vessel and pipes, and Eddie will do the wiring. There's some extra paperwork that needs to be cleared first. So we're waiting on that and still running on the mains at present. Wednesday was a real trip out to Galway. I've been looking at mopeds for a while, a quick and easy way to get to the shops or for a fun run out. A man in Galway was advertising a novel Valentine's Day gift, matching mopeds. We could have one each. It was an interesting drive as the two counties are very different. Galway has much smaller fields divided into narrow strips by rough stone walls. It is, as one friend said, almost medieval. It used to be the poorest of the counties, and a lot of money has gone into it recently. There's evidence of new building and development, but it still looks a bit ragged around the edges. The people are just as nice, however, and the mopeds we chose were lovely. 20 years old, bright red J-Lings, no pedals, two-stroke engines, and perfect for summer days. And then the rain came. The next Thursday, we finally got a bin. Oh, joy. There will be one big clearance next week, and then the bin will be emptied every 6 to 8 weeks. We've cut down our rubbish quite dramatically with recycling, composting and using the cardboard with weed mat to clear the land, so this time frame should work for us. We woke the next day to gale force winds and the bin blown over, wedged in the gate. That was Storm Dudley. Torrential rain, high winds, and cold. Not as cold as we were last year, but still pretty chilly. We did a dash into town for a big shop in case things got worse and headed home to batten down the hatches. Oh, I'm glad we did. No sooner had Dudley left than Storm Eunice arrived. She was the big one, with ridiculous winds, hail, sleet, and even some snow. We were surprised and impressed that the power stayed on, though we took the usual precautions. Filled flasks and a big water bottle, torches and lanterns charged, and our camping stove to hand. We have learned from experience. And then this morning, the third storm in 5 days hit, Storm Franklin. We're getting a bit waterlogged now, and are very glad we had the overhanging trees locked before Christmas. I wouldn't have given much for the roof of the Majestic in all this. I got out another jigsaw, but I think I've possibly overestimated my abilities with this one. It's a monster. Escher's waterfall, not only an impossible world drawing, but all in monochrome. So there we are. A very eventful few weeks. We get the mopeds next week. They need a bit of work, but are now ready for collection. There should be room in the shed for them by then, unless we get another storm. No one's coming up the lane in this weather unless they live here, so fingers crossed for the next few days. And Monday was Valentine's Day, of course. I went to Anpost to get some stamps and came back with a book of special issues. Foolishly, I didn't look at them first. Now I've got 10 stamps, all of them pink stripy hearts. I'm not sure about using them for the bank or the solicitor. It might give them entirely the wrong impression. What do you think?
It's almost as though it's a living audio tale just for the Siren and South Side listener, which is wonderful stuff. Jessica Bertus in Dublin, of course, you're just experiencing some of Jenny's weather in Ireland vis-a-vis storms because you hadn't arrived in February this year. But what are your thoughts on the meteorological conditions of the Emerald Isle?
I think that it definitely rains a lot more than home, but back home we have such extreme weather usually. And it started hailing like one day while I was here. And it's always surprised me because the hail here, it's like little ice chips. And back home, they smash windshields and they're like golf balls. And the weather here though is a lot more windy. The wind is insane here. Ireland has intense wind. I went to IKEA last night with a friend, and our bag like full of stuff started getting like blown down the street by the wind, if that tells you like how strong it is here. So it's a little insane. I'm glad that you were able to like take cover, Jenny, and like be safe through the storms.
It is actually exceptionally bad. The wind has been for the last 4 days. It's the worst I've known it.
It's really intense lately. I don't know if this is like typical for Ireland, but yeah, I don't
worse
enjoy
than
it.
Usual.
I guess so. Yeah, it's a lot.
Perhaps it's just empathizing with COP27, the Congress of Parties 27, and Egypt in general. So who knows? No regrets then, Jenny. Clearly, that's the general tone that comes across, despite a schedule which had me exhausted just listening to it. Clearly, you're settling down quite nicely.
We are. We're bedding ourselves in. We're making ourselves comfortable. And no, we have no regrets. We're beginning to make friends and contacts with people around us. And generally, with just one or two exceptions, everybody has been absolutely lovely and welcoming. And we're very happy here.
Jessica, any other comments or thoughts on this latest opus from Tipperary?
I really enjoyed this week. I think especially the note about the mopeds is so fun. I can't wait to hear about moped adventures. And I love like the whole process of kind of making a home, kind of transforming it from just a house that you moved to. I think that that's one of the best parts of this is just listening to how you're changing it into your home and your place where you feel most comfortable. And I love the long line of names of effort that is going into this project. It is a big affair.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things for us because we lived in Saltburn for one day shy of 31 years. And we started with a house that was a wreck and we made it into something that was absolutely beautiful. And then we had to walk away from it. And so it was very important to us, yes, to have a safe place we could relax and the dogs were safe, but to bring something of our home from Saltburn with us and to make this ours is very important to us. This is our forever home. We're not moving again. Oh God, no, never, never, never.
How are the dogs adjusting as well? How are they doing?
They have a garden here. We had a 10 by 10 yard, and they have 1.3 acres to wander in, and a wood and a garden. And they absolutely love it. They've all made their own spaces. In fact, Charlie's behind me. He always comes upstairs to my room and he's lying in front of a little electric fire on a blue blanket. And that's what he does when I'm writing. I call him my muse. They're all very happy here and much, much more relaxed than they were before.
I feel like nature is like it has the most calming effect. I feel like it's anytime you go out and you're in nature, it just changes things. I miss it a lot, just being able to like walk outside into a garden or a backyard. I think that's so important to people.
Yes, you're right.
Although being based in Dublin, Jessica, you can obviously just walk out into the Dublin streets of the fair city. I'm sure they'll sort of have some back to nature moments there as well.
I mean, we do have a lot of seagulls and pigeons, if that's what you mean. That's like that's the nature that we have here. Very aggressive seagulls.
That's probably why Jenny's dogs were so frightened in Saltburn. It was the seagulls that actually were terrorizing the airwaves and the zones. But that's for another issue for another time. I did like the notion of you needing a pillow to sit on to actually do the radio material. People who are confused, oftentimes we use the Zoom medium so we can actually see our co-hosts from that point of view. It's not a case of just to actually reach the microphone, which is another thing entirely, of course, and another time to be developed. Coming up next, we've got historian Kate Williams who's going to be talking about the way in which you can actually make good use of online services to find out what your ancestors were doing in the first two wars of the 20th century, world wars, that is. And we've also got Gavin Moody, who until recently was captain of England. And I think I didn't actually refer to him in the piece as Mad Dog Moody, because obviously one wouldn't from that point of view. But Lewis, were you a Lewis, or rather Jenny, were you a Lewis Moody fan?
Oh, yes, when he got going, he was a joy to see. You never got in his way.
Well, then you will, I think, particularly find the next interview with Lewis Moody quite fascinating because he opens up about an important aspect of his health, which I must admit I wasn't aware of. And he actually maintains it should be talked about much more frequently within men. So, Lewis Moody coming up next. For the moment, though, Jenny, another classic Tipperary tale, and doubtless another one will be just around the corner.
I sincerely hope so.
Now, when you've actually amassed 223 appearances and 165 points for Leicester Tigers, and then 71 appearances and 45 points for England, certainly within the world of rugby union, you have rightly earned the line legendary to be applied to you. You've also got an MBE as well. Clearly, it just goes beyond that. And that's why we're delighted to actually welcome former England rugby captain extraordinaire, of course, Lewis Moody, MBE, to the programme today. How are you, Lewis?
Very well, thank you. What a lovely introduction that was, Alex.
It's only what you deserve, Lewis, for the joy and happiness that you've brought to so many play people over the years, both in Leicester and, of course, for England. But interesting enough, we're here today to talk about a new campaign that you're launching to really break a taboo subject when it comes to men's hidden health conditions, specifically to do with the bladder. So share with us, why is this something which you felt you really had to speak out about and actually get people, and you know, with us blokes, we don't like to go to the doctor. We put things up on all sorts of basis. We, you know, we need to sort of be brave on that side of things. And what led you to actually sort of say, yeah, we need to talk about this and start addressing these issues?
Well, firstly, thanks for the the introduction. And, you know, I, as a young man, was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis when I was about 27, so in the midst of my playing career. So having to suddenly deal with male incontinence, you know, for me it was bowel incontinence, was something I never expected, because it was due, you know, in my eyes as a young man, it was for elderly people, and I didn't really in my own head understand how you couldn't control your own bladder or bowel until I was obviously diagnosed and put in the position where I found out very quickly, and actually at times realizing that a toilet, you know, being 2 feet from a toilet was too far away, and the challenges that it posed just leaving the house in the morning to get to training, having to find a toilet en route. And this campaign, you know, the Stores for All campaign, really is about raising awareness, first of all, so that people are more open to talk about it. You know, it was only when I retired that I became really most at ease with talking about what I had been through as a player and living with ulcerative colitis, but really pushing for more bins and more facilities in male washrooms, and actually across all washrooms, but male in particular, so that people like me that suffer and suffered incontinence have somewhere to, you know, have their dignity. So you can close that door, you can deal with an issue if it's arisen, an accident that may have happened, as it did to me numerous times on the way to the training ground, whether at Leicester or England, and you can leave it, because having those types of products on standby and in a toilet does alleviate the stress for someone that suffers with male incontinence or with incontinence.
In a real sense, Lewis, you're living proof of something that you can actually manage these conditions, but at the same time, it is important, as you rightly said, to ensure that facilities are there so that folk who might not necessarily understand the whole process of what they're going through and the challenges they're faced with, as you said, the very mention of the word incontinence can actually lead people to actually think, oh, you must be in your 80s or your 90s or something. It's that sort of thing. But, you know, these are kind of aspects which, again, given certain changes, people can actually, as we say, manage the condition, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for me, it was a shock to the system. You know, I was 27, as I said, but, you know, the stat that I didn't realize at that time was that, you know, around 40% of male sufferers were between the age of 18 and 34. So actually, that was the most common period of time to get it as a male. And you just learn coping strategies. You know, that's certainly what I did at the time as a young man. You know, it was moving nearer to the training ground so that the journey wasn't as far. It was knowing which venues on the route to training or to matches were going to be hospitable to someone like me coming in and demanding that I need to use their toilet and with seconds to spare. So yeah, you do find ways of coping, but everyone has a different journey with it, and it's very unique to each individual, and whether it's bowel or bladder, just the opportunity to speak about it. You know, I didn't for a long time, and when I did finally open up about it and I spoke to my mates, and it just became the norm, and they almost they allowed it to become a talking point. You know, when I needed to rush off to the loo in training, you know, it became something we could laugh about, and then it normalized it and the stress disappeared. And also when I spoke to my coaches about it, found out that he suffered from something very similar, but only when we share these things do we understand the common challenges that we go through, and do we make it easier on each other. So for me, talking about it today in this Stores for All campaign is hugely important, so thank you for having me on.
Well, that whole essence of communication is just so vital. I mean, we've had a great deal of discussion, obviously, over the last few years, really, about the importance of opening up with respect to mental health. But presumably, again, there's a direct correlation between the physical challenges that you're faced with and obviously, you know, getting away from the embarrassment and ensuring that people were aware that, well, OK, we deal with it. There's no problems. It's not a case of oversharing. It's just a case of this is the way things are.
Yeah, absolutely. And your point around mental health there, you know, directly links, because, you know, there were times during my playing career where I literally, the thought of leaving the house created huge stress and anxiety. Therefore, you tended not to, you know, until I was fully diagnosed and then given the treatment that allowed me more time to manage that illness. But the more we share things, generally, the easier it is, right? And finding that the taboo or the fears that you have around what people will think and say generally aren't as bad as we may be considering in our own minds. And actually, people are very considerate and caring when you start sharing things, and it essentially makes your mental health better, because it means you can manage the situation a little bit more without, free from fear of judgment, maybe.
people who are listening to this today, Lewis, say people might be similar age to yourself, they might be students, they might be sort of slightly older, where would you actually point them to actually start initiating this conversation? Would it be go to their GP, or would you actually say, no, contact the Bladder and Bowel UK organisation? What steps would you advise them to take?
Well, certainly, first of all, if they're struggling and they haven't seen or haven't had a diagnosis, would be go to the GP. But otherwise, yeah, if they go onto the Bladder and Bowel UK website, then there'll be signposts there for points of contact and where to go next. But the sooner you can share it and talk about it, and even if that first point of contact is with a GP, then I would firmly recommend that they go and do that.
Inevitably, Lewis, I have to ask the question, how do you feel England are currently doing in these moody-less days that we have to actually endure? And clearly Argentina managed to squeak across the line from that point of view. Do you feel generally optimistic, or is it a case of sometimes you watch them and you shake your head and go...
Well, I didn't feel optimistic. I did feel optimistic prior to the game. But I thought going into that Argentina match that actually this is the first time in a while that we could win four from four tests equally. I thought, do you know what? With Japan and Argentina playing as well as they are, it could be the first time in a long time we lose four. So when we fall on the wrong side of the result, having actually on the, you know, on the stats board, you know, defensively put in three times as many tackles, you know, possession and territory was, you know, was highly in our favour. To come out on the wrong side of the score sheet was really disappointing. And it was the first game I took my youngest son to watch at Twickenham as a fan. So we had a great day, but a disappointing end to it. And I hope that the game against Japan at the weekend, they can turn it around.
There must be something about Argentina. I mean, at least you can't say, well, they were handling the ball with the hand of God this time, because that would be part of a rugby game. So, you know, it's a different line entirely. Lewis, it's been awesome connecting with the good self. Really delighted to feature on the programme. And we've got two final questions we like to put to our first-time interviewees at this particular stage. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been good for you?
It's been wonderful. I'm not sure what a Zoomer is, but yeah.
Well, we're using Zoom to communicate today, so I figure let's call it a Zoomer. You know, we used to be telephonic links, so let's work on that basis. So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you come back sometime and talk rugby and, of course, men's health and other issues as well?
I am always up for a conversation on health or rugby, Alex. Yeah, so please do get in touch.
Former England rugby captain extraordinaire. Many people say the best, really. Lewis Moody, MBE, keep on keeping on, and all the very best.
Take care, mate.
I think it was Santayana who said a number of years ago that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. And that possibly is even more true when it actually comes to wars and issues relating to that as well. Fascinating survey recently by British family history site Find My Past has also found out that almost a quarter of British folk don't know if their ancestors fought in either of the two world wars of the 20th century. So to actually talk about the importance of maybe doing some research into your own past and actually ways in which they can actually help this particular aspect, we're delighted to welcome historian, author, and television presenter extraordinaire. Of course, it's Kate Williams. How are you, Kate?
Hi there, Alex. How are you? I'm good.
Great stuff. Yeah, it was ticking over. And obviously, this time of the year, it is a time when we tend to inevitably in the month of November, because, of course, of Remembrance Sunday and so on, start beginning to think back about our past and so on. I mean, were you surprised at all by the findings from Find My Past?
The Find My Past research that very few of us, 60% of us, nearly 60% of us, don't know necessarily very much about our family and what they did in World War One and World War Two. That I thought was really striking research, like you say. And I think that actually so many of us want to know, but we don't know where to go to find the information. And it's so hard to have someone to ask, because we've lost that generation now. All of our great grandfathers, great grandmothers who were part of the World War One effort, they have gone, and most grandparents, even those who came back from World War Two, they are no longer with us. The Queen was one of the last people to be with us, who were one of the women serving in the ATS. We lost her this year. We've lost a lot of veterans from the World War II conflict over the COVID period. So we've lost a lot of those voices to ask individually, what was it like? What did you do? So I think that lots of people want to know, but we don't always realise that now, thanks to all the hard work of all those wonderful archivists out there, that archives are now digitised. They're all digitally on there. So you can go at the touch of a fingertip, just find out about your family history and the military records. I think people don't always realize as well, even though wars are a time of crisis, and World War One and World War Two was a time of crisis and at times chaos, the meticulous records that were kept by the army, so you can find out exactly where everyone was. So I mean, I'm a historian. I love history. It's my job. I love it. And I found out stuff on Find My Past about my ancestors that I didn't know. My great grandfather, he fought in World War One. He was in France. I knew he was in France, but I didn't know. I never seen the actual record that his brigade kept to the night he died, severe shelling. He died of gas poisoning after severe shelling. Hadn't seen that. That was incredible to see exactly where his grave is in France. And also, I didn't know he'd been hospitalized earlier in 1915 for an injury probably caused by he was a gunner pushing the gun around. And, you know, that is, was so fascinating to me to just see that information all meticulously written down. And the names of the other men with him, they must have been his pals, his friends. He spent every day with them for all those years. They were looking forward to coming home. And he died just a few months short of Armistice Day, which we would commemorate this weekend. And that was so moving for me to see. And so there is so much information there, so much brilliant information. Find My Past actually goes right back, there's parish records, right back to the time of Henry VIII. So they're really early records. But the military records are so meticulously, so carefully kept, that there's just a wealth of information. And it means that you get sort of this huge, we know the big story about World War One and World War Two, but it means you get the story of all these individual lives, individual sacrifices that went together to create this great historical significant moment.
As Professor of Public Engagement with History at the University of Reading, presumably this is a fantastic link in with that, because obviously it's exactly what it's about. It's really showing how history is alive. It is actually still there. I know it's almost a cliche to start talking about, oh, yes, well, the one thing about the Germans, for instance, is they kept fantastic records. And of course, Britain gave administrations to the world in all sorts of ways. But this is something where I suspect, for many people, the journey might well have a number of heartaches. It may well have a number of tears being shed over the sacrifices that were actually made. Does that human nature of the story come across? Because sometimes when you're just going through data and you're just going through that data, you think, yes, born, etc. It takes away really from that whole sense of, yes, but these were living human beings.
Well, yes, Alex, I think you do get that insight. And what really struck me was that my great-grandfather, he died in 1918. It's such a tragedy. And he left behind my great-grandmother, who had five small children. And she lived to a ripe old age. She lived to over 100, got her telegram from the Queen. She died when I was a teenager. And I just feel so sad that I didn't ask her many questions. Of course, she was old and quite tired by the time I was, you know, a young person. But she... What there was on the Find My Past site was her application for a widow's pension. And she says that she has these children and she signs it with her name. And that actual handwriting was so moving to me. As you say, this is a story of great sacrifice, great suffering. Even those who came home, it was still suffering and distress after what they'd seen, trying to slot back into civilian life. There's a lot of tough stories there, but I think it's really moving to see these individual stories and reminding us that all those graves that we see in these huge grave sites, they all commemorate a husband, a father, a son, someone whose life meant so much to so many people around them, and how society had to try and deal with life when they were gone. So I love it that you get both the big story and the individual life. No one's going to make a huge documentary about my great grandfather, but I remember him and being able to read about his life, because he's a part of me, one of my family. I remember him. I remember his sacrifice. I remember his suffering. And I really, you know, I think about how hopeful he must have been that the war was coming to an end in 1918. And yet it was the final few months in which he died after surviving for so long.
Find My Past, of course, are offering free access to all of their records, including military ones, over Remembrance Weekend. Presumably people who are listening to this who think, oh, yes, I can't possibly afford that. It's not a huge amount. of finance that's needed to, obviously, as you say, delve into the archives and actually do a bit of digging.
Well, yes, Alex, Find My Past is free to register, to sign up with this weekend up until the 14th. It's all free. All the information is free. And you can go in there, make a family tree. If you've just got one birth date, one death date, a name, you can really find a lot. I mean, I have a very common name, particularly in Wales, Williams, and I still find lots of material there. So it's free to use, and all this incredible material is there. And within, I think, an hour, you can really gain a lot of material. It's like this incredible historical sleuthing. And also, Find My Past, if you upload, find some, when you've got the material, if you upload it to their channel, Stitch, you can win a free subscription as well. So you can also have free access, but the chance to win a free subscription. So you can spend your whole year looking into all kinds of stories, all kinds of war stories, of your family, of all those who fought from around the world, from the empire, from the Commonwealth, from all over the world, and were stationed all over the world, these incredible records of these great world conflicts in World War One and World War Two that shaped the 20th century in so many ways.
And arguably still continue to shape the 21st century with respect to a number of other issues. But that's for another debate for another time. For the moment, as the human adventure continues to develop and grow, historian, author and TV presenter Kate Williams, huge thanks.
Thank you.
Keep on keeping on.
Thank you. And you. Thank you.
Staying warm in the winter, it's a challenge, or can be in the Northern Hemisphere, or indeed Global North. But it's even more of a challenge these days when fuel costs are clearly rocketing skywards. And 69% of us are concerned about keeping our homes warm this winter. One in five folk are actually struggling with heat retention. And over a third are saying that heating, well, maybe we'll just freeze to death. Let's actually talk to ACE, home heating expert, to actually get his take on the whole thing. That's the wonderful Dave Rabal. How are you, Dave?
Hello, good morning, Alex. I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
I'm okay. I mean, obviously, we've heard an awful lot over the last few months about people who might be actually just staying in their office because it's warmer in their office than it would be at home, and all manner of sort of ways to actually coordinate things from that point of view. But let's talk about why it is so important that our homes are actually kept reasonably warm as the inclement weather comes along.
Yes, totally. So I'll back you up on the stats you had there. We did our own survey recently. About two in five British people now saying they're not going to be turning on the heating at all, or they're going to be waiting until it's much colder. One in six saying they're going to be not having any hot water baths. Hopefully they'll be having showers or maybe cold water baths. And a lot of people doing other things such as switching off all their electrical appliances at night. It's a big thing in this country. So there are some terrible stats to talk about as well, sadly. Is that we have in this country about 10,000 people every year die of fuel poverty. It's the worst in Europe by a long way. 10,000 is a lot. So about a third of those die literally of hypothermia. They're too cold at home. And about two thirds get pneumonia, et cetera, and move to hospitals before dying. And that's more than the number of people killed on the roads, suicides, murders, all put together. It's a big thing. And tragically, you know, I don't want to sound there, but probably be a lot worse this year. And the reason for that is our homes are very poorly insulated. So British homes look wonderful, great architectural styles. But if they were like our cars and had to have an emissions test every year for their MOT, then most British homes, sadly, would fail their emissions homes and have emissions tests and have to be scrapped. And that's where we're at. We have a very poor housing stock from a thermal perspective.
So clearly there are folk who go back to their forefathers and foremothers and they'll be saying, well, just wear more layers, just wrap up warm, just effectively use your own stuff, et cetera. I mean, that can help, obviously, to a certain extent.
Sure.
But presumably the key thing is we need to be looking at some insulation to ensure that our homes become, A, more energy efficient, but also perhaps don't start burning fuel costs literally from the moment we switch on the first bar of the fire, shall we say.
Yes. So there's a climate change conference going on right now in Egypt, isn't there? And I'm sure they'll be talking about new forms of renewables and stuff like that. That's great. But the best energy is the one you never use. So insulation isn't so sexy as all of these other things. But actually, if you don't have to switch on your heating, or you can switch it on for shorter periods of time or for less, it saves yourself money. It reduces fuel poverty deaths, as we talked about, and it's good for the environment as well. So There's a lot of things we can do. I can talk if you want about some simple things.
Let's take your advice now in terms of some simple, yeah, cost-effective ways that can actually keep us warm in the winter months.
Yes. Okay. So the first thing I would do in any home I was in is stop drafts. So on a cold winter's evening, go to every window, go to every door on your property. You don't need any fancy technology. Just use your hand, find the drafts and stop them. So you can stop them. There's lots of things you can buy very easily online or from DIY stores. Draft excluders around windows at the bottom of doors. Put thicker curtains on if that's something you can do. Consider a door curtain. These things used to be quite common in olden times. If you can't do any of those things, just at least for the winter, maybe just use some tape around your windows to stop any drafts. There's no point heating all of the air in your home and letting it go straight out again, right? So you don't want to do that. So that's the number one thing I would do. And the number two is put in more loft insulation. So heat rises. It's not rocket science. And in a typical British home, 25% of your heat goes out through your loft and then through your roof, and you lose it that way. So put in insulation. Most people have some insulation already, usually between the joists. It's a bit dark and dusty, but go up and have a look. Usually only 2 or 3 inches. The government now recommends at least 300 millimeters. That's about a foot. That's a lot. So put that in. Easy again to buy from a DIY store. Doesn't cost very much. And the other thing, the final thing I'd say on the insulation is make sure you don't squash it. And this is something actually our survey found that most people did not know, that we all live in crowded homes. Everyone wants to use the loft for storage or to walk around in. If you do that, do not put boxes or boarding directly onto the insulation or onto your joists, because that halves its effectiveness. It works by being fluffy. It traps air. You squash it, it has less air, it works. It actually halves its effectiveness. So put in lots more insulation. And if you want to use your loft, then get somebody's online. Lots of people sell raised loft flooring systems. Get some of those to protect your insulation.
I was fascinated to see that number one in cities of the UK with the coldest homes is actually Brighton. I always thought Brighton on the south coast would be very warm, but it's ahead of Birmingham, Glasgow, Bristol and Liverpool. I mean, were you surprised with respect to that? And Nottingham, of course, being the place which has the warmest home.
So actually, it's to do with the age of the properties, isn't it? So Brighton, a wonderful Victorian spa town back in its day, now a city. Lots of old properties right by the coast, so lovely in the sunshine in the summer. Pretty cold with a biting wind in the winter. And in other places like some of the Midlands and Northern towns have a lot of new build flats on average, and they at least have a higher thermal performance.
And I was, again, intrigued to see in terms of the list of cities in the UK who can complain the most about cold in the home. It's Leeds, Cardiff, Edinburgh, Glasgow and Newcastle. So obviously in the north, we just like to moan quite a lot. And that's a key thing.
Well, I'll let you answer that. I'm a Londoner, so you're not quite the north in Lincolnshire, but you can have a better perspective, I think.
Yeah, I suppose we're closest to Nottingham in terms of that. I couldn't actually locate where Lincoln was. However, where can people actually go to find out some more of the tips that we've been talking about today, and indeed some more details about this particular survey, and hopefully ways of actually ensuring that people do stay warm this winter, and also maybe even save a few pennies as well?
So lots of great resources online. There's the Energy Savings Trust, which is a government-funded organisation. There's National Energy Action in Newcastle upon Tyne. They help people in fuel poverty with ideas and ways to get grants. There isn't a lot of money available. There is some for the very poorest communities, but unfortunately, David Cameron once said, we're going to scrap all the green crap. Which he did, which meant that we have less insulation.
He has such a fantastic legacy. I mean, he's got that, he's got Brexit, it's got wonderful. I mean, obviously, he'll go down in history as a genuine prime minister who left a footprint, shall we say, not necessarily a green footprint.
A large carbon footprint. And the carbon footprint, regardless of your politics, means we end up spending more money on fuel and we're more reliant on, unfortunately, gas from places like Russia.
Hopefully people will find some useful information from some of those suggestions you've made. David, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. Dave Ravel, home heating expert extraordinaire. Keep on keeping on. And presumably, I noticed you're wearing a jumper today, Dave. I mean, as indeed am I. So obviously wearing those layers is quite important as well, I would have thought, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong. You don't need to wander around at home in a t-shirt and your underwear. You can if you want to.
It's not a good sign at the best of times, so I wouldn't cancel that.
My business Loft Zone, we make sure that everyone's properly wrapped up warm for when they go out into people's homes to do the insulation, for sure.
Dave Ravel, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thanks, Alex. You too.
It's fair to say you may not have heard of the re-commerce economy in a world in which sustainability certainly seems to be the buzzword, but Barclaycard payments are certainly addressing the re-commerce economy. And to actually make sense of this and also give us his own unique insight into our shopping and retail habits, we're delighted to welcome back to the programme once again, retail expert extraordinaire and, of course, ace commentator, Harry Wallop. How are you, Harry?
I'm very well, Alex. Thank you very much for having me back.
Always great to connect with a good self, because we can always guarantee the listener insights that are very well framed from your own point of view, which is always important. So let's talk about this Barclaycard survey, which does suggest that sustainable word is very much becoming ever present in our particular shopping habits.
Yes. So they haven't actually come up with the term, the re-commerce economy. It's been floating around in America the last year or so, but I think it's a very useful umbrella concept for what are actually a bunch of quite old fashioned behaviors. So recycling, reselling, reusing and renting rather than buying new. And it's kind of two things that are coming together. One is the juggernaut that is the cost of living crisis coming down the track, and many people already feeling the pinch quite severely. And then there's this long term kind of bubbling away in the background. People are worried about the environment, but that has really taken hold in the last few years. And it's no longer, oh, I ought to do the right thing. People really care, and they want to make sure that any consumerism that they do isn't destroying the planet in the process. So why not maybe rent a dress or rent a chest of drawers or rent a bicycle rather than go out and buy it brand spanking new, and then it just sits there. Big asset that's cost the planet a fair amount, not really being used.
And so I was intrigued to see that more than 8 in 10 of those who've actually chosen to rent items as a matter of course, rather than buying new, they've done so over the last 12 months. That's 80%, which compares to 49% literally 3 years ago back in 2019. So clearly that seems to be the way that people are going, that they're not necessarily looking for permanency, but they are looking for things which obviously have a certain returnable value, as you would say.
Yeah, and I think renting has really changed from, you know, it never crosses anyone's mind that, you know, you go on a foreign holiday and you rent a car. That's, you haven't got a problem with that. So, you know, renting has been around, obviously, since the dawn of time, but it's renting things that you might not have thought about. So renting fashion is the one thing that's really taken off in the last couple of years. It's become lots of quite specialist platforms have come about selling really quite high-end fashion. But also what's amazing is that some of the retailers themselves have embraced this idea and are now experimenting with renting. So this Barclaycard payments report obviously surveys a lot of retailers who use them, and they discovered that 40%, 4 in 10 retailers are now offering some form of rental. And the huge majority have done this in the last year. So there are some quite big names. We're starting to experiment. There's the likes of John Lewis, Marks and Spencer, IKEA. I mean, big household names who used to make their money from just selling us stuff and now realize there's a whole bunch of consumers who just don't want to buy new stuff every time they're going to a party or to a wedding. They might want to rent it.
I can almost hear certain conspiracy theorists shouting at the radio or the podcast device that they're listening to this particular piece on with the words, this is Davos, this is the great seat reset, in the future you will own nothing and you'll be happy. I don't think it's as sinister as that, Harry, but in terms of the change in the shift in behaviour, we certainly seem to have moved along from when I think traditionally one might consider renting a tuxedo for a wedding or a funeral or something. And as you say, it seems to be becoming normalised.
It is becoming normalised. I mean, famously, whatever you may think of our former prime minister, but I've lost track, two prime ministers ago and his wife, so Boris Johnson and Carrie, she did help sort of normalise the idea of renting high-end fashion. I think she rented her own wedding dress, but also to various quite high-profile conferences. Yeah.
I suppose that when you're marrying into the Johnson family and dynasty, maybe you don't know how long it's going to last, so you've always got to have your options open, really. But it's just an observation, really.
Well, indeed. Indeed. But I think renting has now become, and there is, of course, there is a whole generation of young consumers. When I was growing up, you know, nearly everyone aspired to own their own home or their own flat. That was not considered weird. It was possibly, you know, 74-75% of the population did it. And you could be one of those. And now, of course, that's within a generation fallen really quite substantially. People now accept the idea that you will rent your own home, but also like a car. You know, a car is a huge, big piece of metal. They're obviously fantastic. I'm not anti-car in any way. I do indeed own one. But will the, you know, my kids probably won't own a car. They will probably rent one. If they're only going to use it once or twice a month, you know, it's crazy to invest that money to have you sitting outside your door. So it's all about the infrastructure, whether it's possible. You know, it only works if really with a click of an app, I can go and rent that car with no hassle. And that is happening with things like dresses and with jewelry and with handbags and actually increasingly with furniture. And I think we will just see more and more. And there's, of course, technology helps enable all of this.
And it is a way of actually addressing that long-held issue that when you buy a new car, once you drive it off the forecourt, it's already depreciating in value second by second, really. So that's another line for another debate. Harry, where can people find out more about this particular Barclaycard payments research?
Well, the easiest thing would just to be put into a search engine, Barclaycard payments and re-commerce economy, because that's the buzzword that it sort of sums up this whole new wave. Shopping, re-commerce economy.
And do you think this is something which should presumably be on the agenda for the COP27 folk who are obviously chatting away and doing their whole system? Do you think they're also aware of the financial implications of obviously getting more sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. Because this, I mean, I genuinely do think this is part of the future. And I think increasingly large number of mainstream retailers and brands will start off, you know, giving the option of either you can sell something back to us, you can rent something from us, giving tips about how to reuse things. I think consumers want to buy from companies that they genuinely trust are not damaging the planet.
Hey, the absolutely classic line there, the trust, the T word in full force. Harry, it's been awesome connecting with your good self because we always trust you to give us fantastic information and insights. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer yourself? Has it been okay for you?
Yes, it has. Thank you very much, Alex.
Good. So I take it then we can prevail upon you to join us again in the not too distant future. Will you return?
Of course I will.
It's always nice to have a good news story around this time of the year as we begin to wrap up 1 year and look towards the next and think, well, Christmas is around the corner, isn't it? Yes, and indeed, people across Great Britain are indeed getting in touch with the true meaning of Christmas with a fascinating and wonderful response to the opening week of what is referred to as Little Bear's Toy Bank. Who is Little Bear? What's Little Bear's Toy Bank? How can you get involved? Well, we're going to find out in the next few moments because we've got the Chief Executive Officer of Neighbourly, the wonderful Steve Butterworth, with us today. How are you, Steve?
I'm very well, Alex. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to connect with your good self and even better to actually talk about this particular journey that Lidl, of course, the supermarket, has actually gone on with you to ensure that people are basically able to spread the meaning of Christmas from that point of view across the country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a fantastic campaign, and with Little Bear's Toy Banks being open in more than 940 of Lidl stores nationwide, it's a great opportunity for people to get involved, to make toy donations at a time of what is an incredibly exciting time for kids, against obviously the backdrop of what are, you know, very challenging times too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the cost of living crisis, the energy challenges, the problems with respect to war in Ukraine. I mean, it could be never ending. But from that perspective, it's clearly quite fascinating that toys being collected by local charities alongside food donations are going to be distributed via local charities and community groups. And again, presumably, this is the length and breadth of Britain.
Yeah, absolutely. So nationwide in every store, and every store then connected with a local charity or good cause that's already collecting surplus food from that store. And they came back to us and they said in terms of the survey that toys were second only to food when it came to the demand for donations over the Christmas period. So it'll be a mix of food and toys that little stores are able to get their customers to donate to and then pass on to the local communities that they serve.
I know we've spoken in the past about Neighbourly, Steve, but for the benefit of the listener who might sort of think, so Neighbourly, I like to think I'm Neighbourly, but let's talk a little bit about Neighbourly as an award-winning giving platform that matches businesses with local good causes, because this was very much your dream, I believe.
It is, and it's exactly what you just said there in terms of it's about helping businesses that want to spread the love and find the way of connecting with hundreds and in Little's case here, thousands of local good causes all across the country. And it's those local good causes that are often the most trusted in our communities. And Neighbourly's there to be able to make that as easy as possible. And as we know, trying to activate that social or environmental purpose at a local level, but do that at scale is not easy. So yeah, for Neighbourly, it's been amazing to be part of a campaign like this where we're able to touch every corner of the UK.
It seems astonishing to realise that Little GB has actually been with us for 28 years. It's nearly three decades since it opened its first store in 1994. I mean, clearly, as you mentioned, 940 stores, 13 distribution centres in England, Scotland and Wales, and 28,000 employees. Is this something where, again, the connection of Neighbourly can really help make a difference, to use that cliched phrase?
Absolutely. And if you think from those sort of stats you've just read out, Alex, they've hundreds of locations. And what is it that an organization like Little can do to support local communities? And this Toy Bank initiative is part of a much sort of wider program that Little runs as just part of the DNA of the organization. So their Feed It Back program is around that daily food surplus redistribution program. They've also got a community fund as well. They're donating £250,000 as part of this Toy Bank initiative. So it's what resources has a business got to give away, and an organization the scale of Little being able to have that sort of localized impact can make a massive difference.
It's good to know that Little is not going to be adopting any form of Scrooge-like approach to the festive season. So that's vital. Okay, Steve, how can people actually, who are listening to this particular piece, how can they get involved? How can they actually support it? How can they find out more about the actual programme itself?
So to donate, you go to your nearest Little store where you'll find a Little Bear Toy Bank deposit box. Generally, it's near the exit, usually next to the food donation points. But if you wanted to find out where that local store is, you can go to little.co.uk/toybank, and it'll tell you the local stores closest to you. And if you want to go to Neighbourly, you can then see the charities that they're supporting. So neighbourly.com/little, and you can find the local charities that store is supporting.
Fantastic. It's probably also worth noting that you're looking primarily at new or unopened toys and games, not necessarily pre-loved ones. They are obviously fun, but I think you're looking for obviously the new ones to obviously be part of this particular campaign.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So new or unopened.
Steve Butterworth, Chief Executive Officer of Neighbourly, huge thanks. It's too soon to wish you happy holidays, but I'll simply say keep up with the festive work, Darren. And indeed, Steve, shall we say.
Thanks so much indeed, Alex. You too.